Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we're going to do a go-back. We really didn't finish the Constitutional Convention, but yesterday we started breaking forward on reviewing everything that we read from Madison's notes. We didn't read it comprehensively. We just gave you the highlights. And I went out of my way to find out every instance where they discussed their commission and so forth and so on. So that's why we kind of discussed that yesterday. We'll move back into focusing on why our state legislatures are allowing themselves to be enthralled by two groups that, what I've been accused of liking to hear myself speak, that's all these two groups are doing, is they're talking in a vacuum, and they're not calling each other out the way they should, because shame on them. Shame on the convention state folks, and shame on the anti-convention, or the conventionites and the anti-conventionites. Because they've got everybody believing that this is a binary argument, that either we have to form a constitutional convention to deal with our problems, or we have to basically ignore the problems altogether, because that's what the anti-conventionites are proposing. So anyway, and I hope anybody can prove me wrong, because I want to see that. The intent is uniting. We are going to be cursed as a people and as a nation of this time if we fail to put aside our differences, and if we fail to put aside our self-interest in doing what's necessary. I can see the real challenges we have, because back in our framers' day, they took the time without pay to do a lot of the things that they did because it was the right thing to do. And nowadays, you want me to do something, it's going to cost you some. I'd be happy to come and do that, but, you're going to have to pay me this much money to make it worth my while. That right there is the spirit of heaven, isn't it? Anyway, so in the Constitutional Convention, for the most part, George Washington didn't say anything, and he kept his silence. And what ended up happening is the convention literally started getting ready to sign the Constitution, and George Washington basically had this speech that he gave to Benjamin Franklin, which he handed it then to Mr. Wilson, who then read these words from the president. And it's kind of addressing to himself, so it's almost veiled. But if you actually do the research, what we're reading here right now is basically Jefferson's contention that he had with the Constitution, not Jefferson, Washington's contention he had regarding representation. And we want to show you how this one contention of 40,000 people to be represented by one person was changed in the last minute to 30,000. And this is important, because the reality, and I want you to always think this, what is adequate representation? How can we adequately be represented, if we're fighting 1,000,000 to 1? Because we're not being represented, folks. And Washington actually takes a stand. We need to trim this down. We need to go to a smaller number. So with that, let me ask Sean, if you wouldn't mind reading, let's read the first two paragraphs. And then Tammy, go ahead and then read the remainder of those paragraphs along with Mr. Gorham and Mr. King and Carroll's motions and so forth. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay. So, Sean, go ahead and basically read Dr. Franklin Rose, and then read those two big paragraphs, and then Tammy can read the last of it. Go ahead. Thank you.
Dr. Franklin rose with a speech in his hand, which he had reduced to writing for his own conveniency, and which Mr. Wilson read in the words following. Mr. President, I confess there are several parts of this Constitution which I do not at present approve, but I am not sure I shall never approve them. For having lived long, I have experienced many instances of being obliged by better information or fuller consideration to change opinions even on important subjects, which I once thought right, but found to be otherwise. It is therefore that the older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment and to pay more respect to the judgment of others. Most men indeed, as well as most sects and religion, think themselves in possession of all truth, and that wherever others differ from them, it is so far error. Steele, a Protestant, in a dedication tells the Pope that the only difference between our churches in their opinions of the certainty of their doctrines is the Church of Rome is infallible and the Church of England is never in the wrong. But though many private persons think almost as highly of their own infallibility as of that of their sect, few express it so naturally as a certain French lady who in a dispute with her sister said, I don't know how it happens, sister, but I meet with nobody but myself that's always in the right. Not even going to try that last part.
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
Oh, I probably could do that. Nuit à que moi qui a toujours raison. Little Cajun accent.
There you go, okay. So
these sentiments, sir, I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if they are such, because I think a general government necessary for us, and there is no form of government but what may be a blessing to the people if well administered, and believe farther that this is likely to be well administered for a course of years and can only end in despotism, as other forms had done before it, when the people shall become so corrupted as to need despotic government, being incapable of any other. I doubt, too, whether any other convention we can obtain may be able to make a better constitution. For when you assemble a number of men to have the advantage of their joint wisdom, you inevitably assemble with those men all their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. From such an assembly can a perfect production be expected? It therefore astonishes me, sir, to find this system approaching so near to perfection as it does. And I think we'll astonish our enemies who are waiting with confidence to hear that our councils are confounded like those of the builders of Babel, and that our states are on the point of separation, only to meet hereafter for the purpose of cutting one another's throats. Thus I consent, sir, to this Constitution, because I expect no better and because I am not sure that it is not the best. The opinions I have of its errors I sacrifice to the public good. I have never whispered a syllable of them abroad. Within these walls they were born, and here they shall die. If every one of us in returning to our constituents were to report the objections he has had to it, and endeavor to gain partisans in support of them, we might prevent its being generally received, and thereby lose all the salutary effects and great advantages resulting naturally in our favor among foreign nations as well as among ourselves from our real or apparent unanimity. Much of the strength and efficiency of any government in procuring and securing happiness to the people depends on opinion, on the general opinion of the goodness of the government, as well as of the wisdom and integrity of its governors. I hope, therefore, that for our own sakes, as a part of the people, and for the sake of posterity, we shall act heartily and unanimously in recommending this Constitution, if approved by Congress and confirmed by the conventions, wherever our influence may extend, and turn our future thoughts and endeavors to the means of having it well administered. Excellent.
Hey, on the whole, sir, we cannot help expressing a wish that every member of the convention who may still have objections to it would with me on this occasion doubt a little of its own infallibility, and to make manifest our unanimity, put his name to this instrument. He then moved that the Constitution be signed by the members and offered the following as a convenient form, done in convention by the unanimous consent of the states present the 17th of September, etc., in witness whereof we have hereunto subscribed our names, and quote, this ambiguous form had been drawn up by Mr. GM, I can't remember who that stands for, in order to gain the dissenting members and put into the hands of Dr. Franklin that it might have the better chance of success. Mr. Gorham said if it was not too late, he could wish for the purpose of lessening the objections to the Constitution that the clause declaring, quote, the number of representatives shall not exceed one for every 40,000, end quote, which had produced so much discussion, might be yet reconsidered in order to strike out 40,000 and insert 30,000. This would not, he remarked, establish that is an absolute rule, but only give Congress a greater latitude, which could not be thought unreasonable. Mr. King and Mr. Carroll seconded and supported the idea of Mr. Gorham. When the president rose for the purpose of putting the question, he said that although his situation had hitherto restrained him from offering his sentiments on questions depending in the House, and it might be thought ought now to impose silence on him, yet he could not forbear expressing his wish that the alteration proposed might take place. It was much to be desired that the objections to the plan recommended might be made as few as possible. The smallness of the proportion of representatives had been considered by many members of the convention an insufficient security for the rights and interests of the people. He acknowledged that it had always appeared to him to himself among the exceptionable parts of the plan, and late as the present moment was for admitting amendments, he thought this of so much consequence that it would give much satisfaction to see it adopted. No opposition was made to the proposition of Mr. Gorham, and it was agreed to unanimously. On the question to agree to the Constitution enrolled in order to be signed, it was agreed to all the states, answering aye.
Aye, indeed. Okay, so this was so important. And folks, when you start looking at taking control of your government, you have to understand that the only form of government that is a safe government is one that is constrained and confined. We've learned the lesson and the beauty of a system of creating very limited and defined powers, not allowing government to exceed those powers. This goes to the whole crux of our problem today, that we have a government that recognizes no limitations. They believe that they can control and dictate what the standards of carbon dioxide in the air should be, as if they're that omnipotent. We actually have people, or I should say the conventionites, have actually made the argument that the only mechanism within the Constitution that allows we the people to hold them accountable to staying within these confines of the Constitution is the Article 5 Convention. As I was about to say yesterday, that the amendment process is very finite and it deals with three specific things. In other words, if the Constitution doesn't need either of any of these three things, you're not talking about making an amendment to fixing the Constitution or fixing a problem. You're making an amendment to change the Constitution. And I'll give you a case in point when I finish with these three things. First off, an amendment is necessary when the Constitution is proven to cause the problem. I gave the example of the 12th Amendment to the 11th Amendment. If there's a deficiency, we will actually run into a wall when we try to choose the president, which is why the 12th Amendment was suggested, when we actually had a very vicious election cycle between Adams and Jefferson. The 11th Amendment was also necessary because the states realized that the federal government was getting way too much in the knickers and wasn't benefiting the Union in doing so. And so they took back the jurisdiction from the federal courts. But I'm telling you today that the federal courts have got back into that jurisdiction. But that being said, now when we look at the deficits in the Constitution, such as slavery and so forth, it does require an amendment. You have to, if there's a problem with the actual language in the Constitution that doesn't jive anymore, it doesn't hold water, we're not supporting or standing by and allowing states to engage in slavery. Therefore, we needed to amend the Constitution. So when the Constitution has a deficit or deficiency or a problem, you must amend that to fix that problem. Nobody can argue that. If the federal government can't get a job done because we need them to do something, and we want them to be the ones to do it, such as creating our highways and waterways, they don't have the authority to do that. So for them to do that, we need to amend the Constitution, granting them more power, more ability for, you know, spending money on these things delegated to, you know, highways, waterways, improvements, establishing, what have you. Remember, it is a very specified and confined power that we're delegating. We just don't give them a general power. Go do anything you want. Because that right there would put the Constitution on its side. And so that's one other form of an amendment when we need to grant the government any type of change of power or what have you. If, by chance, we don't want the federal government anymore being involved in something, such as the mail system. The mail system is antiquated. We don't need to do that anymore. And I'm not an argument. I'm not giving you an argument that we need to get rid of the mail system. We need to take it back. And as a matter of fact, this I know this opens a can of worms, but bottom line is that the Constitution established a mail system for the federal government to provide for the people so that we could communicate at all levels of government and so forth down to grandma and grandchildren, the ability for people traveling abroad or what have you to use the U.S. mail and the mail systems of other nations to be able to get communications from anywhere in the world or anywhere within the United States to another person. So we've got a mail system, and that is actually constitutional. Our healthcare system isn't. Our mail system is. And so if we don't want to have a mail system, then it requires that we remove that from the Constitution. But until then, we just can't say we're not doing it anymore. That right there would be a violation of the Constitution. And what has happened with the mail system is a problem as well. But nevertheless, so those are the three only reasons why we would ever utter the words amending the Constitution. To convene a convention that won't do any of those three things is a convention to change, wholesale change, or make very dangerous changes to the Constitution, i.e., let's just call it term limits. Will term limits solve the problem of government overreach? Absolutely not. Anybody that thinks it will is delusional, because what's changing is you're just basically putting somebody in with no experience, and you're getting rid of somebody with experience, but you're still not holding those people in government accountable. You're just changing and making sure that you got a different class, and you're basically ensuring that more people get exposed to the corruption of government and its processes, instead of actually holding government accountable and ending the corruption within government. That right there is holding government accountable, and there's no amendment to actually end corruption. Term limits does not end corruption. we have to actually interpose and demand compliance of the Constitution. That is a completely separate process. Interposition is a completely separate process, and it has nothing to do with the Constitution other than enforcing the Constitution. So when we look at all the problems that we have, because when we look at the two groups, the anti-conventionites and the conventionites, they'll both agree the government is out of control. They have their own newspapers. They have their own writers that write these stories that, you know, that don't do a very good job in telling you what's constitutional or not. But what they do tell you is government is out of control. And these things are, you know, problems. These things are violations. Well, they're not supporting the idea of holding government accountable, directly accountable. Because what is the process of holding government accountable if it's not a convention which is designed only to make changes, very specific types of changes to the Constitution? Then what is the process? Tammy, any ideas?
What's the process of changing the Constitution?
No. What is the process of holding government accountable?
Petitions.
There you go. Is that in the Constitution, though?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, thank you. In unison. So where do the conventionites get off saying that the convention is the only process in the Constitution of, you know, holding government accountable, the getting government back into those, you know, things that they're supposed to be doing? There's no amendment that says you got to do what you're supposed to do, pretty please. That doesn't do it any more than what we currently have by the 10th Amendment. Powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states and the people, respectively. There's a little more to it than that. But bottom line, the 10th Amendment covers it. The 10th Amendment is more than sufficient to say that you can't do anything that's not delegated. Ergo, why would they say outright that the only process in the Constitution to deal with government overreach is the convention?
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. I don't know.
Because I want to be objective, and tell me if I'm missing something here. One, they could be that illiterate on the Constitution that they don't realize that the Bill of Rights and all these amendments are actually a part of the Constitution. And ergo, they can't dismiss any of those amendments. If there's anything within the Constitution and its amendments that actually provides a process of dealing with overreach, and they say nothing else exists in the Constitution, then they're that illiterate on it. That's one excuse I'm giving them, that they're basically a victim of their illiteracy, and you can't fix stupid unless they're convinced to sit down and start reading and start learning on their own. You know, you can take a horse to water, but that doesn't mean they're going to drink it. So they're going to be trapped in this paradigm that this is the only thing we can do. This is the only thing we can do. And you come up and you show them otherwise. Well, this is the only thing we can do because they're incapable of seeing it. They have to learn it. That's either they're...
Yeah, I will never understand. I'll never understand how they think changing the Constitution is going to make them start adhering to the Constitution.
Well, so I've laid out the three ways or the three purposes for an amendment, for making a change to the Constitution. The Constitution is actually the problem, where there's something in it that needs to be changed, or they need more power, or we need to take back a power, role, responsibility, some kind of change like that, to finally tweak something. So those are the three purposes, and anything else is actually very destructive, i.e. just throwing a general power out there, like either term limits or the balanced budget amendment. That right there would literally destroy our form of government, a balanced budget amendment. Literally destroy it, because it basically changes everything. It takes us away from a limited and defined spending. You can only spend on these things. The balanced budget amendment basically says, well, you can spend this much money. It doesn't matter what you spend it on, but you can spend this much money and it can't exceed the GDP or what have you. Are you serious? That is... That gives them the authority to spend money on things they have no authority to spend on. Why would you do that? We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we look at the anti-conventionites, because the conventionites really, they're not making a case. There's no way that anything can support a convention. And as I look at all of the states that have signed off on a petition to form a convention, and the slack jaw, speckless arguments that have been used, we've got to do this. I'm going, wow, I can't believe there's that many state legislatures that have been duped. Duped. believe it or not, folks, I'm at a loss of words. I guess we just need to end the show right now because I don't know what to say. But hold on here. I've got other things that I have sentiments about that I might actually find some words on. Let's talk about the anti-conventionites and their side of the argument. Because the anti-conventionites are saying, no, no, no. And we addressed this yesterday. They kept on saying that the first one was a runaway convention. Like, hey, it's been solved. They've determined, because their clairvoyance and their omnipotence, they have been able to deduce that what happened in the Constitutional Convention in 1787 was a direct violation of every delegate's commission that they were not to propose a constitution. Technically, there's actually empirical data that proves them wrong. And we went through what did give them the empowerment to do what they did, and they felt more inclined to do everything that they did. And as a matter of fact, we even, on the very ending of how to get the Constitution through and out to the states, to basically give it to the people. I mean, the state legislatures may not have liked what these guys did, because they knew that these states were going to be the problem. These states were, thinking that they had a good thing going, and they weren't going to let anything take away their power, their power base. So how do you get rid of that? They had to bypass it. And they were very well aware of the entire landscape. These men were very well aware. Now, I will say that the conventionites and, the kind of the late ringleaders of the conventionites have come up with a long list of personal notations or personal statements from people that were in the convention and all around, the time, where I don't care if it was 500 people that said that, yeah, the delegates exceeded their commission in some journal, in some newspaper article, that's hearsay, right? In law, I don't care how many people you paraded to say, well, they did this. That's all hearsay. The reality is that they actually solved the problem, because the anti-federalists, just like the anti-conventionites, broached this same problem. And Pauline Mayer kind of covers the documentation on this. I've never taken the time, nor have I assembled the documentation, because I just don't have the time to do it. But you can read her book, and she accounts for the fact that in a couple of the states that vigorously debated the Constitution, the delegates or the leaders, the ringleaders, like Patrick Henry, and a few of the other ringleaders in the few states that said, we're not going to do this. They exceeded their commission. They violated what we told them to do. So what they had to do was, before they even convened as a convention, they had to determine as a body whether they were going to debate the Constitution or not on the question of whether they exceeded their commission. So in other words, the delegates that went to the convention to debate it were tasked with the decision, did they exceed their commission first? And not one state convened and came up with, yes, they basically violated their commission. Ergo, they don't debate the Constitution. They walk away from it saying, this is a product we should not have received. Not one state chose to say, hey, they exceeded their commission, or support that theory. A lot of, you know, hindsight, a lot of, you know, hyperbole, a lot of people in out of context. I have no idea. I do know, and I have seen plenty of documents from the anti-conventionites have produced documentation regarding nullification that takes literally statements from Jefferson and others completely out of context. They just take this one little soundbite that says, yeah, they exceeded their commission. They even use Madison's Federalist Papers 40 and 41, where he basically defends everything that they did in the convention. But they use that against him as he makes the sidewards oblique to say, maybe we might have, but that is not what he was actually saying, because he was defending everything that they were doing. So the reality is that evidence in itself, or do you have to actually convene a jury? And the only way to do it would be a jury of the time. We can't. It's too late to do this today. So they get away with making the assertion of a tired and already resolved issue that, oh, it was this, and we don't have any evidence of this, because that those documentation of determining whether they exceeded their commission or not was not a part of the debate. It wasn't a formal part of the debate, so it wasn't included. When you look at what they did in the documentation, so I have no idea where Pauline was able to acquire this, but hats off to her, because she did the thorough work on this by going through the different states. And, you know, for me, not having access to all of that type of stuff online, you know, it's now it might be in the University of Wisconsin's documentation history of the ratification of the Constitution. It might be in there. And I think she might have mentioned that. But I until somebody buys me that, because there's a couple thousand dollars, until somebody, you know, bequest me, or, you know, what's the term when they, you know, give that to me. But the problem also is that those are hard documents. In other words, they don't, what the University of Wisconsin is not doing is they're not putting all this online. Because, and to me, this is public information. This is, you know, it is so valuable that I can't believe that they're actually out there trying to make money off of this. Anyway, all this being said, so the anti-conventionites basically said, first off, it was a runaway convention. We even dealt with the word runaway. That's an inappropriate word. These men did what they needed to deal with the exigencies, not a runaway, to deal with the exigencies of the Union. And they did a doggone good job. There we go. Sorry for being tongue-tied. They did a great job in innovating and figuring out how to create a Republican form of government, a superior Republican form of government, and still give the federal government very limited defined powers where they couldn't really cause harm to the Union. The anti-conventionites are now telling, so as they've been kind of called out in the later days here by, you know, myself and maybe others. I don't know if anybody else has been calling them out on nullification, but that's what they're saying. Oh, well, we need to nullify. You don't need to have a convention. Just to be clear here, I want to give everybody the background on this, and I want to get further into the background later on at a later point in time, because I was actually with an individual at Red Pill Expo in 2019, where at that point in time, the chief editor for an anti-conventionite institution was, you know, given an introduction to me, and this friend was basically explaining, you know, this concept of Republic Review and everything, and this anti-conventionite said, you know what, I'll take a look at this. I'll take a look and I'll let you know what I think. Never heard back from him. Ran into this person three times. And, I never got it. You have to resend it to me the second time. And then the third time, okay, what? So I haven't done anything. I'm not going to do anything. So what? Now, he didn't say that. He just basically walked away. But the third time when I met him, I said, you know, I can only surmise that you're literally lying to me, because you haven't lifted a finger to try to come back and tell me anything regarding what I've sent you, regarding Republic Review and the process of holding the federal government accountable. Silence. And you've told me that you would get back to me, and not a peep. Ergo, the only thing I can, you know, refer to you as a man that doesn't keep his word. You're a liar. Change my mind. And actually give me feedback. And let us sit down. As a matter of fact, I've been asking this institution, as well as the other anti-conventionite institutions, to say, stop with your failed argument. End this discussion of whether we convene a convention or not anymore. And let's actually talk about what are the options of dealing with government overreach. Don't jump to the conclusion it's either this or that. There are several different options. And I believe reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree, and we will all walk away with the academic evidence and proof that's put on the table. We will all agree that interposition, as James Madison and Thomas Jefferson attempted to do in 1798, is the only way to do this. And interposition being led by First Amendment petitions, this is why we started this whole show and this whole curriculum on what our forefathers did in standing up to England. When they were violating and not living up to the law of England and the Bill of Rights, the Magna Carta, and violating those things, they used First Amendment petitions. And that's what educated them, brought them together, and ultimately they decided to fight a revolution. We don't need to revolt against this beautiful government. All we need to do is get rid of the bad people in it. And it's not like we're having to kill a king here. These are our representatives. And this is the beautiful thing. Our Creator gave us a government that does not allow us, or does not require us, to have to fire a shot to purge this system. He's given us the ability and the power to do it ourselves, by actually demanding and holding them accountable, removing them from office and banning them, and putting people in that we will hold accountable to doing what needs to be done, and we're going to get it done. You have to be a part of this. The problem is that we're dealing with, and the reason I have to spend this much time and effort throughout the year in taking these little asides, is because there are disingenuous institutions that are actually self-serving. They're more concerned about their retirement fund and funding those who went before and are now, you know, sitting and lapping up, you know, a retirement, you know, a nice little retirement on the expense of today's generation, in lying and basically misrepresenting and perpetuating the problem. Because it's all about servicing their retirement scheme now, instead of actually stopping communism and stopping the deterioration of our government. It is very frustrating. So, with what I just monologued, and forgive me, both of you, what are your two cents on this? Tammy, we'll start with you, because you've kind of been in this throw at the Wyoming side for quite a while.
I mean, for me, I feel the same frustration as you. There's still some legislators that were still vote for the Convention of States, and And, you know, we've spoken to them and tried to explain to them, and they just still don't see it. So for me, it's very frustrating because I don't understand how they can't see fixing the you can't amend the Constitution and make them abide by the Constitution by amending it. So
okay, so there is another possibility. I mean, I didn't include the fact that there may be something in it for them. There may be an opportunity by actually, you know, passing this legislation, they might have a chance to go to the show. Anybody that understands baseball, that means going up to the big leagues from the minor leagues. You know, being able to go to the show means that if they go to the convention, then they have a, you know, the sky's the limit now. Look what they can do after going to that convention. And so, in other words, their motivation is self-serving. It has nothing to do with the honesty and the reality of whether they can fix the problem or not.
I don't know. I don't know if it's self-serving or not, but
okay,
it's frustrating.
I'm just trying to come up with why else would somebody, you know, make a hardcore commitment to doing something that's not going to work? I can understand on the anti-conventionite side, some of these organizations have been around for a long time. And they do have, you know, retirements and so forth. At least some of them do, because they've basically had a financial model to basically support that type of organization. Some of these other ones are maybe more on a shoestring and so forth. But I'm here to tell you that the thing that's keeping us, these organizations and these institutions are keeping us from being able to all unite on a table and basically bringing their best and their brightest and say, this is why we need to do this one thing. And instead of letting the table decide, I believe America needs to decide. I believe that, you know, let all the facts get placed on the table and then you decide. Because I believe that when people really look at the truth and what the Constitution offers us, and what we can do, and what would happen by taking our government back. Folks, your state would start thriving again. Because it's not just about the money and the regulations and all these things that the federal government is doing unconstitutionally. It's all about freeing your state from those regulations. Now you can actually start regulating yourself. If you're not harvesting, if you become impotent in being able to harvest your own resources, such as minerals, such as, you know, timber, what have you, then you're the problem, not the federal government. Because there's no reason why you can't come up with ways of being productive and getting things done without harming the environment, without killing people, and so forth. The only reason we've got this death and all of these poisons and so forth is because they're all hiding behind the federal government and their regulations. Because the federal government regulates all corporations now. Put that back into the states. I'll bet you anything the states would actually be far more diligent in protecting themselves and their people. So help me out here. Why is it that we can't be trusted? Why is it that, no, you know, we've got this. Does anybody know or remember the movie The Star Chamber?
No.
Okay. Sean? Star Chamber. Remember that movie?
No, sir.
Okay. So the Star Chamber...
I've heard the name, but
It's an obscure movie that came out, I think, in the 70s that talked about these empowered men that worked under the veil of secrecy, making decisions and, you know, deciding the directions of what's to happen. And in context, this is like that secret cabal that is deciding what's best for this nation and all nations and how to move forward. They're basically the ones that are calling for what the next move on the board would be. That you're going to do this because they have their own agenda. They're not here serving us. They're serving what they believe is best for us. It's the epitome of the conspiracy theory. So
I don't even believe they're serving what they think is best for us at this point. I think they've been, how should we say, allowed into a society. Might not even be a secret society, but they've been allowed into a membership group where they either go along with the ideology of the group or they're cast out. And the people are not considered part of that group. The people are, and the control of the people are how they facilitate the success of their group.
Yeah, so...
Cabal.
Yeah, cabals, right. And so...
And it's like the healthcare system.
Yes.
Like you were talking about, that's what made me think about, is what would be the point of curing your patient if your motive is profit? If your motive is helping your fellow man and healing the sick, then you want to cure people. But if your motive is profit and expansion and success of your business model, then you don't want to cure people. You want to keep them coming back.
Okay.
And I think that's where the government is now. And I think it's a good analogy to the Pharisees and the Sadducees of Christ's time, where they took the law and turned it into something else, and they weren't administering the law for the good of the people. They were administering the law for promoting the culture of the law.
So let me give you a good case in point, because this is really deep, and I'll try to be, you know, as concise as I possibly can. I believe that the evil... One of the most evil things that can happen is, because we're at that age in society with technology and so forth, that one of the most evil things that can occur is creating immortality of humanity. In other words, being able to genetically engineer out our mortality to where we don't age anymore beyond our prime, that, you know, we take a pill and this pill will basically take our age back to, you know, our body will start renewing it and get back to, you know, 28 or 30, wherever that prime is of the human body, strength, capacity, and so forth, and we live the rest of our life in that immortal state, to where we never have to suffer the pains and sorrows of death unless it's by our own hand. But the fact is, it's evil because we don't have to ever come to this, I'll just say, you know, the consequences of our life. In other words, in the eyes of God, that I believe would consider this an abomination, because we would never, ever be held accountable, and the atonement would be completely nullified. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so,
and then you got the other end of it, where they want to upload themselves to technology so that their, whatever they want to call it, it's not their soul or their spirit, but their...
conscience.
Consciousness.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, is preserved.
But it's preserved...
Yeah, that's weird.
All of these things are evil, but I believe that when all of a sudden, around the corner, when the plagues and everything starts hitting us, all of a sudden, Satan and the Antichrist will come out and say, hey, you know, we have something that will, you know, allow you to be completely impervious to the heavy metals and all of these types of things, that this one change to your body will basically take you back to your prime state and you'll live forever. How many people will run to that drug and just gobble it up?
Most.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what Christ said.
And so that's why the Bible says that he will deceive all people, because people won't see the consequences of immortality, because it literally wipes out the whole purpose of the atonement and our returning to his presence. These are big consequences, yeah. Folks. But again, back to the conventionites and the anti-conventionites. They're afraid of actually fixing the problem, and they don't trust you. They want you to follow their guide. As a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why when you look at these institutions, the conventionites and the anti-conventionites, because there's more than just the convention of states. There's the Just Amend group. There are different groups out there that are all kind of working together with their own little spin on being in the conventionite camp, just like the anti-conventionites. It's not just the John Birchers, the, you know, Eagles Forum, you know, the New Eagles Forum, or actually I think the Eagle Forum is now split between the New Eagles Forum and the Old Eagles Forum. One side is conventionites, the other side is anti-conventionites, and the 10th Amendment Center, and so forth. So these different institutions and organizations, they're afraid of actually solving this problem, because if they solve the problem, then what are they going to do when we actually understand what we need our government to do and hold them accountable? Then what purpose do they offer? They'll actually have to become, you know, skilled craftsmen, or they'll have to get an education, you know, to bring productivity. Well, if we don't allow AI and the automations and everything else to destroy us, because we're afraid of working an honest day's work. And I'm telling you, folks, some of the old school lessons need to be taught to the children today, because they're being pumped with a lot of evil information that they'll never have to work. Just imagine.
I heard a report just the other day. I think it was Mike Rowe was also, I think he was being interviewed, and he was talking about how there is this new trend, like in the last year or two, where Gen Z are starting to trend towards those traditional trades and blue collar work, because they're involved with the technology every day. So they have a more innate understanding of what it's capable of and what it means. And they understand that they're the ones who are going to be most affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was very encouraging. He said the Gen Z is trending toward blue collar work and more traditional trades, and there's a lot of people out there that are working towards that. So when we talk about that, I just like to give some encouragement to people, not to say that it's fixed or any in any measure, but that we are going towards that, because the kids nowadays understand what they have in their hands and what technology is doing. They're not as apathetic as we tend to give them, you know, put a label on them as that. They see what's going on.
That's a perfect.
And I think God has a hand in that as well, because there's a lot of revival going on in the younger generation.
So that's a perfect segue to end the show. Because tomorrow we're going to start on the ratification debates. Folks, we fill that gap. Unless you understand the type of government we have, then you have no appreciation for what this government can do for you. Or I should say, how we can actually serve ourselves in self-governing and basically moving more of the power back to us locally, to the counties, making, you know, literally changing this paradigm by the design of the divine hand of providence to bring, you know, most all decisions to the local level. We don't want, other than, you know, foreign relations, these limited powers, you know, at the local level. We want that at the federal level, but all other powers should be at the local level. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. And again, we will be diving into the ratification debate starting tomorrow. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.